But we are going to do a I forgot the order that we were doing all of this.
Are you okay? Did I throw you off that
badly? A little bit. I'm a little derailed, but I can get us back. I can get us back.
Okay. Okay. Get us back. Bring us home. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Just imagine that we did the opening of the show and
we did
it wasn't weird at all.
Nothing weird happened.
There was nothing but content. It was amazing. The audience is with us. They're hooked. They're like, I gotta get those movie reviews.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. San Diego, California's Keith Foster is on the other line.
That was a weird way to introduce me from the host of the show in Los Angeles, California, Cassidy Robinson.
This is the last week in which I'm going to be living in boxes. Well, at least the last week for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I don't think you can make that promise at all, because
no,
I guarantee you're going to be living out of boxes again at some point.
I guarantee it as well. And also, this tends to come up about once a year for some reason, whether they're painting the walls or they're fixing something or whatever. I've unpacked my movies off the shelf about once a year for one thing or another. But I'll tell you what, when you're living in your room and you have to pack away everything, you start to like get a feel for like what minimalist living must be like.
Yeah.
I mean, I still have my TV and everything plugged in, so it's not exactly the same, but you know.
No, I do know. I used to live in a much smaller house. You saw the house I used to live in. It was about 600 square feet, so me and my wife were kind of had to do tiny house living.
It wasn't a tiny house. It was like it was an apartment. It was the size of an apartment, like a, you know, in New York, Manhattan, it would be a gigantic apartment. In California, for a house, it was smallish.
It was 600 square feet. I think the cutoff, like the official cutoff for a tiny house, is 400 square feet. So it's not that far off.
It was economic, though. Like, I never felt like I was in a hobbit home or had to crouch to get anywhere.
No, it was a great little place. But we had to, the point I was getting to was when we moved into it, we had to purge a lot of unnecessaries. Uh-huh. So, which was really nice and actually pretty freeing. It was the first time I've done, like, since I moved out of my parents' house, that I've done, like, a massive purge of stuff.
Yeah.
And the stuff from my parents' house was, like, you know, they still have a lot of it, just in boxes somewhere.
Today we are going to be reviewing, what are we reviewing? We're reviewing Crazy Rich Asians. Mm-hmm. And in our Netflix homework, we're going to be talking about Tale of Tales.
And before that, we're going to do a little thing called Consume Obey.
Yes, we are. And do you have anything in mind? Because I kind of scraped the bottom of the barrel of my life this week.
I actually have to, like, narrow my things down.
Oh, damn. Okay.
But I have a couple things. One of them is...
You don't want to go through all of them, because there could be a week like this last week where I felt like it was a weekend and then 2 days and then another weekend.
Oh, no. Trust me, I have plenty I'm saving.
All right.
One of them is dumb. But it's very thematically appropriate. I just got a new t-shirt.
Okay.
Yeah, and normally I wouldn't bring up a t-shirt, but it's actually a really cool They Live t-shirt that I got from Mondo.
Oh, Mondo?
Yeah, uh-huh. So it says They Live on the front, and it has like a TV with one of the aliens on the back.
Yeah, is it color or black and white? the print.
It's color.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's a gray t-shirt. It's very comfy. I mean, it's just a t-shirt. But,
all right.
I just thought it was kind of funny because it's a They Live t-shirt.
And this is the Consumo Bay. Yeah, okay, I understand. There's a famous video store here in Santa Monica called Cinephile. It's right over by the Lemley. And they sell, like, novelty movie t-shirts. And their big thing is they have a bunch of t-shirts that look like famous band logos, like Metallica and Pantera and stuff like that, like the famous logos from their merchandise and their CDs and whatever. Yeah. But they say directors' names. And of course they have Carpenter, but it's spelled like the Carpenters. And then it has a picture of Karen Carpenter and her brother with the They Live faces.
That's actually pretty funny because John Carpenter is a touring musician now.
Yes, that's true. Him and his son playing his scores from yesteryear.
He's done original stuff too. It's actually pretty cool. This was not intended to be my Consumo Bay because I haven't listened to it lately. But he has a couple albums. I think they're called The Lost Soundtracks.
Yeah.
And they're very, you know, if you're into his digital synthy vibe, they're really cool for like background mood music.
Okay.
But the other thing that I'm going to bring up is an oldie but a goodie. I just made my wife watch Predator for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the OG, the get to the chopper Predator.
Yeah, we mentioned this last time because it brought us into our whole conversation about whether or not The Rock is the new Schwarzenegger.
I think it was something else that brought us into that.
No, it was that.
Oh, well, anyway, I just wanted to talk about it a little bit. It's such a good damn movie. The first one is so all over the place. Insane. And watch that movie again. And
I've seen
tell
it.
Me, watch it again with it in like recent memory and tell me that the Native American soldier is not the main character of that movie.
Or you're led to believe that he is.
He should be. I think that if Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, if Dutch had been the one to stay on the bridge and fight and die off camera.
Yeah.
And had the Native American be the main one to fight him, the Predator at the end, which they obviously didn't do solely because of Schwarzenegger's star power.
Right.
I think it would be a damn near perfect monster movie.
Okay. I mean, I think it is a damn near perfect monster movie as is.
I do too, but story-wise, I think it really would have made more sense for him to be the one to really bring it home.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because there's the whole... I think you're led to believe that he's going to, like, really, like...
I mean...
You're led to believe that he's going to be a badass, and he's going to do this damage because he's, like, already sort of a predator whisperer without having ever seen one before, but he's like this natural hunter or whatever. And then of course he like dies off screen in a few seconds. And every fanboy in the history of since the movies come out has always like pined for the movie that could have been with that character and felt that he kind of died in a wussy way.
No, but it's not that he died in a wussy way. It's that it is very unsatisfying and doesn't really have any sort of story payoff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the payoff is supposed to be that you think he's a badass, and then even he goes down, and that's when you're supposed to know shit just got real.
I think you could have gotten the same effect had Schwarzenegger been the one to stay behind.
Well, yeah, if they had pulled like a fucking Psycho and had a protagonist switch in the middle of the movie, that would have been bananas.
I don't think it would have been a protagonist switch, but it would have been like, whoa, they just killed off the fucking star of the movie.
Right.
I maintain that I don't even know the character's name, but I maintain that he should be the main character.
All right.
I don't think it would feel like a protagonist switch. It
coming actually, soon to the internet, we have Keith's fan fiction of the rewrite of Predator 1.
I'm saying it actually feels like a protagonist switch the way that the movie does it.
I think you're high a little.
I don't know, man. I'm telling you, rewatch it from that perspective, and you'll be like, oh, shit, yeah, Dutch is not the main character.
Until he definitely is.
Yeah, yeah. Which was 100% because of the star power of Schwarzenegger.
Maybe. The only thing I have to really talk about, I was listening to Axe to Grind podcast, which I think I've talked about on this segment before, and they did a new music episode where they just kind of went over like new releases of the last few weeks or last month or so. And it's good. It's a good sampler to just know what's going on out there. A lot of stuff that I wouldn't come across otherwise. And there's a few bands on there that are pretty neat. One that I've heard about for a long time, but I kind of didn't check them out, called Gouge Away. And it's a kind of a female-fronted hardcore band. It's kind of like an older style, not as like heavy and moshy as the stuff that's really popular right now. Sounds a little bit more traditional. But I hadn't listened to them before, even though I had heard of them, because obviously, the name probably comes from that Pixies song, and that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way for some reason. Like, I'm a fan of the Pixies, but I was like, "What? It's just everyone knows that. Like, that's like naming your band Wonderwall. Like, don't do that."
Fuck it, do it. I don't give a fuck if you're a good band.
No, I know. I'm just saying, as a person, that's why I slept on them as long as I did. But then when I heard them in the new music episode, I was like, damn, this band is actually like really good and doesn't sound anything like the Pixies. But there was another band on that playlist that they went through called Haan, H-A-A-N, New York kind of experimental hard rock band. I'm not actually even sure how to categorize them because they're doing so many things. And this band I really enjoyed, kind of ticked a lot of boxes for me. So there's kind of have like a early 80s, like Killing Joke, Christian Death kind of post-punky kind of sound, but then also like a heavier New York, like Helmet, Quicksand kind of post-hardcore vibe. And then also like Louisiana sludge type stuff like I Hate God and Crowbar, like all at the same time. And actually pulling it off. And I listened to their whole record yesterday, both that and the Gouge Away record, and quite enjoyed them. So there's that. Let's go ahead and get into the listener survey, kind of. This isn't really a listener survey. I'm stealing somebody else's survey. Ashley Hitchcock, who's been on the show before, she decided to do a Jabber and the Drone and posted this on her own personal page. But a lot of the people who follow us on Jabber and the Drone actually responded. So I told her, I'm going to steal this today, if you don't mind. And she posted,
you said that like you wanted me to reply as her.
we're doing a bit now. No. She said,
I'm role playing as Ashley.
You don't have to, tell this me what movie you think is quote unquote perfect. She says Prince of Egypt, kind of a bold move there.
I have never seen it. I know it was a not Disney sort of attempt at making it. I don't know. I can't say anything about
Spielberg
it.
Spielberg produced it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know it's Bible-y.
It's the story of Moses. You know, two brothers. He kind of focuses more on that aspect of it, which is a thing the Bible doesn't get into so much. The Bible's never really been great at emotional storytelling. So Steven Spielberg injects that by
Cassidy putting the Bible on blast.
he sort of presupposes this established relationship between Xerxes and Moses, and like how tough it must have been when it was brother against brother. It's good, actually. You know, it is. There's reason why it's still kind of talked about today to some degree. It's maybe not as much as it was back in the day, but yeah, I it wouldn't be my first choice, but I see no problem with that. It's been forever since I've seen it.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so I don't know.
I was a child. I think it was on Netflix for a little while though. Okay, her friend Brooke says Return to Me. Do we know what movie that is?
No.
I can't say for certain. Life is Beautiful, Pan's Labyrinth, and My Neighbor Totoro. List of shame. I've never seen My Neighbor Totoro. I've seen very few Miyazaki films, to be honest. I've only seen like a handful of them. Pan's Labyrinth, I would agree, is pretty much perfect. Life is Beautiful, also I've never seen, and I've never really had too much of an interest in seeing it.
So Return to Me was from 2000, starring David Duchovny and Minnie Driver.
Okay, now I remember what that was. I've never seen it, but when I worked at the video store, I remember putting it away all the time.
Yeah, I have not seen it. Yeah, I would agree with Pan's Labyrinth, but I haven't seen any of the other movies. I also have not seen My Neighbor Totoro. I've only seen a few Miyazakis.
Yeah.
Is Grave of the Fireflies Miyazaki?
Well, he didn't direct it, but it was released through Studio Ghibli. So it's in that world. It's the two or three directors who do the Ghibli films.
Yeah, because that movie will straight up fuck your day.
Yeah, I've heard it's a bummer. And super and bummer. Yeah, I've really only seen maybe like four at all. And not like the big ones too, so I won't even out myself. Okay. Nanette Nielsen says Finding Neverland. I only saw it the once when it came out. I remember liking it enough. But that's one of those things, so it's not necessarily like a mediocre film or something, but it probably just didn't speak to my sensibilities as much as other things do. Sure. But it's not a bad movie.
Yeah. I, again, haven't seen it.
Yeah, you have, because you saw it with me.
Did I?
Yeah, we saw it at the Real Theater when we were living on 9th Street together, and we were doing Johnny Depp's Irish accent all the way home because it was stuck in our heads.
I really don't remember that movie then. All right.
We'll have to a big impression on you.
Yeah. Scott says Boondock Saints.
I'm going to have to disagree on that one.
I wouldn't say it's a perfect movie. I think it's a fun movie.
How long has it been since you've seen it?
Oh, it's been a long time. It's a fun college movie.
I'm going to say like high school. It's all right. I've seen it like in the last 5 or so years, maybe longer than that even. And I remember it's actually one of the sharpest thought it was good turned out not to be rewatch experiences of my life. Like,
oh, I'm all right. I guess you're wrong, Scott.
Yeah, but I'm not going to say that no one's allowed to enjoy it or go through that phase or whatever. But I don't know. Cassidy's
putting everyone from Scott to the Bible on blast tonight.
Well, you can make fun of... Well, no, we'll tell ours at the end. I'll skip that.
Yeah.
Brad Page gives like a list. Like a list to end all lists. So we'll run through these. King Kong, the 1933 version. The Gold Rush. Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, 1946. The Haunting, Gattaca, Jurassic Park, Raiders of the Lost Ark, North by Northwest, The Bride of Frankenstein, A Night at the Opera, Throne of Blood, Pather, Pencelli? That one I'm not familiar with. Mm-hmm. And Doctor Strangelove. So, representing all the eras.
Yeah,
film history. Brad is a true cinephile.
I will say I will agree with Jurassic Park,
yeah,
and Doctor Strangelove.
Those two are really good. Yeah,
I Raiders of the Lost Ark is not even the best Indiana Jones movie. Fight me on this, nerds. Last Crusade, all the fucking way.
Yeah, I kind of prefer that one myself. I think Raiders is maybe more iconic in some ways because it was the first of its kind, and it like established a whole new sort of like genre in the 80s and blah, blah, blah. Like it's the, I think it's the more impactful film in history. But you know, if I just want to sit down and watch one of them and I can only watch one, it's probably going to be Last Crusade.
That's right.
La Belle et la Bête, or the, Jean Cocteau's, Beauty and the Beast is gorgeous, and people should see that if they get a chance. I saw it over here at the Arrow a couple years back, with Wings of Desire, which was the German film that was eventually ruined and turned into City of Angels.
Hmm. All right. Katie says, Inglourious Bastards, Pineapple Express, and Big Hero 6.
All of those movies I like and dislike in about the same proportions.
The only one I would maybe give that to is Inglourious Bastards, but
That's the one I like the most.
Yeah, I enjoy all those movies, but I don't think any of them are perfect.
No, in fact, I think all of them have like glaring flaws. That actually like the type of flaws that really annoy me because they're so close to being perfect otherwise. Especially Inglourious Bastards, but Pineapple Express is probably the one that it's like I'm can kind of live without generally. Like it's, I don't know, I'm just not that into stoner comedies unless they're especially good, and I don't think that one is. But I get that there's like a huge cult fan base for that movie, and it's there. Big Hero 6, I liked it when it was out. I haven't thought about it a lot since.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it's aight.
All right, we have a lot of these to get through. So
I know.
Less
Chantel says, Donnie Darko, The Shining, Kubrick's version, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, one of the middle ones, Across the Universe, and Tangled. I'm pretty cool with this list. I've never seen Across the Universe. Something about that movie really annoys me, and I can't put my finger on it.
No, I know. I've seen it.
Maybe it's jukebox musicals. Generally, I'm not that into.
Well, it's not even that. It's like it's a jukebox operetta.
Yeah.
So there's like no real dialogue between the scenes. So it's that one's a little harder for me.
And then it's Beatles music, which just there's like I will say, kind of like boomer era worship that bugs me.
I will say visually, it is gorgeous. It is a really
cool, so you have seen it.
Yeah, but it's on. To me, it's about the same as like Pink Floyd's The Wall. Like, there's this real loyal fan base for it.
Yeah.
But to me, it's not really a movie. It feels just like a string of connected music videos. It's just that it's not music by the original artists.
Right. Or.
But I'm not going to shit on it. I know it has a very loyal fan base. I just...
Yeah, there's a specific person who, like... I mean, one of my good friends, Amanda, who's been on the show, she has an Across the Universe tattoo.
Yeah, so. I mean, Ashley really liked it, but it's just not really my thing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't... You take this however you want. I think there could be, like, a boy-girl thing going on with that.
Maybe. I don't know.
I'd have to survey more people on that, but I think it is a movie that maybe speaks to that a little bit more.
We have so many more to get through.
Not really.
Justina says, Everybody Wants Some. Glinda says,
Casablanca. Oh, you're just, now you're running through all of them.
Yeah, I'm just running through them.
Okay.
Casablanca. Look at Glinda. She has a huge list. Casablanca, Citizen yes. Kane.
Yes.
2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
Schindler's List.
Okay.
Black Klansman.
All right.
Crazy Rich Asians.
I'll withhold.
Get into that. Young Frankenstein.
Sure.
The Shining. I'm assuming Kubrick's. Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
The Godfather.
Yeah.
Jaws.
Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz.
Good list.
Yeah, I mean, that's a solid list.
Some of those are kind of new. I think she might be a little drunk on the recentness of it, but good list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ashley, my wife, says Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I think that might be the only repeat in here, actually.
No, I see 2001 a couple times. I see The Shining a couple times.
Yeah.
Amy says our idiot brother.
That's a bold choice.
Yeah, I never saw it. You saw that one, right?
Yeah, it's funny. It's, you know, it's kind of a quirky little thing, little widget of a movie that's out there. If you really like Paul Rudd and his style of comedy, you'll eat it right up, which I do, and I did.
I did see this one. Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't... I think that probably sounded a lot more condescending than I meant it. It's just a... To me, that movie is like... It's a comfort food movie.
Yeah, very charming.
And then I think this is the last one. Rob says Batman, the 1989.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Apocalypse Now. The Matrix,
mm-hmm.
2001 A Space Odyssey,
mm-hmm.
Pulp Fiction, and yep. The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Batman 89, it's kind of funny that a lot of people, like, there's a very revisionist kind of, like, ever since the Nolan movies, now people have a hard time with the Tim Burton ones because they date a little and it's just a very different vision for the character.
I still largely prefer Burton's
take.
Yeah.
Feels the most like the comic books at that time.
It also, in a weird way, this might sound insane.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, it also almost feels the most theatrical to me.
You mean cinematic? Or do you mean theatrical as in, like, campy? Because you're right in both regards.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to argue with Nolan's visual eye. So I don't want to say cinematic.
I actually... Hot take, maybe, but I actually think that Batman Begins has visual problems. Like, gorgeous vistas, and then the fight scenes are really muddled.
I'm thinking more the Dark Knight.
Yeah, which is the peak of that era.
And even The Dark Knight Rises has some insanely good visuals. But
yeah.
To me, the art direction of the 89 Batman is undeniably better.
Well, it seems more of a piece, whereas Nolan's was about naturalizing it,
yeah.
And making it seem like it could be real, or turning it into like a Bond movie, basically. Whereas Tim Burton's really like puts it in a world, which is what Tim Burton does. Sometimes to good effect, and sometimes not.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that they're necessarily better movies, but I think generally, I prefer them. Like, I prefer that interpretation to Batman, where he's sort of this larger-than-life legend versus just a guy who knows Muay Thai.
Right, exactly. I think if you're looking at, like, each director's output in that character, like,
yes.
Even though Tim Burton Tim Burton didn't get three movies, but I think his two movies... as a statement, is more successful than Nolan's three movies. Because really, you have one and a half good movies in those three.
I'll say more consistent, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you consider to be a perfect movie?
Whenever somebody asks me this question, I have a lot of options for answers. But I usually say Clueless for a couple reasons. One, I enjoy it a lot, which this question has nothing to do with. You can be a perfect film.
No, and I actually think that some people who answered the survey were answering with their heart.
What their favorite movie is. Yeah.
Yeah, versus what a perfect movie is. Because for me, those answers can be wildly different.
Yeah, I think you can acknowledge something. Like, if you're the most objective critic of all time, you can acknowledge something as a perfect film and hate it.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand like how stories are constructed. But the reason that I like to say Clueless is, for one, it's a little bit of a ringer. Like, people are like, what? Because most people don't think of that genre as something to hold up to any kind of regard. But I think what it does in that genre is perfect. It does that genre as well as it can be done, basically, sure. The teen comedy genre. coming of age, whatever. And I think that it is so tightly constructed. That's like one of the best screenplays ever written. Like, you can't move a scene. You can't take something out, and it weaves together all of its story threads so economically. And it's not overlong. It doesn't outstay its welcome. No scene drags. It is just like perfectly composed little piece of movie. And that's why I like it. And I you know, when I'm looking at comedies in particular, I think about that movie.
Do you think it has anything to do with it's loosely based off of the story of Jane Austen's Emma?
Possibly, and as big of a fan as I am of Clueless, I know nothing about Jane Austen or Emma. I mean, I know who Jane Austen is, but sure. I've never seen any other adaptation of Emma. I've never read Emma. So maybe there's a framework there that she's able to kind of, Amy Heckerling is able to fill in.
Yeah, I think,
but I still think that the way that it does it and the way that it establishes all the characters, there's, you know, we get everybody's like relationship to each other like immediately, and nothing ever seems weird. It's also one of the best like cast movies for an ensemble at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, half of those people are like super famous now.
I think that classical literature updates as romantic comedy well. Like, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You is obviously, it was based off of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. I think that's another really solid teen romantic comedy.
Yeah, and She's All That. That was a very post-Clueless little era, though. What about you?
Oh, God, I don't know. The answer I have in my head, I just don't want to answer it because I feel like we've talked about it to death on this
The Transformers podcast. Animated film.
No. Although that is such a good movie. I think the obvious answer is Jaws. I think Jaws is a perfect movie. I just feel like it's so well known. It's such a perfect movie that it's a lot of people's go-to of a perfect movie. Mm. And so I want an answer that's more clever or more,
a little less go-to.
Yeah, but when it comes down to it, I honestly think that Jaws is perfect. Like there isn't, because when I think of a perfect movie, I think there's nothing that could be improved upon. There's nothing that could be changed. Mm-hmm. Not a single aspect of it. And even, I think of like The Dark Knight as a nearly perfect film.
Yeah, that's a great movie that has very high highs, and I mostly adore it. But it has a fourth act that could be chopped off.
I don't like the portrayal of Batman. I would change certain aspects of the way that character is portrayed in that movie. So to me, it cannot be a perfect movie.
See, that's the only one of the Nolan movies I feel feels the most like Batman. Or at least it left me at a point where I'm like, okay, now we're Batman.
I agree with that. It's just that in the Nolan movies,
he's a very passive character.
Yeah, and he's kind of we have yet to really see a Batman movie where he's the detective.
I felt like that one got the closest because at least you have the stuff in Hong Kong and whatever, and then he builds like the Patriot Act screens and all of that stuff.
Yeah, but all of that is done through Alfred or Lucius Fox.
Right.
None of those things are initiated by him. Like, I think it's Lucius Fox or Alfred that tells him about what's his name being extradited to China, and so it's just that Batman himself doesn't actually make any of these choices. It's all either Alfred or Lucius Fox using.
Yeah, that's Batman. What I meant by Nolan's Batman has always been very passive. It's like all of the decisions he makes is because of Rachel or Alfred, or like everyone's just kind of like slapping him and telling him the next move to make.
Exactly. And Yeah. So that's all I'm just using that as an example of a movie that comes so close to perfect, but it does have things I'd change. The only movie that I can actually think of that doesn't have a single, I think, waste of anything is Jaws. I think it's a perfect movie.
Yeah, and funnily enough, it was a very troubled shoot. And there are some people who have said that the movie was saved in editing, that the there was, you know, there was so much problems with the mechanical shark and they went back and did reshoots at one point, but it, like, the final product is perfect.
Yeah. I just,
so whatever journey we had to get to there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my answer. It's not clever or original, but whatever.
Yeah.
Neither am I.
Okay, cool. Well, let's do it. We're gonna talk about Crazy Rich Asians now.
All right.
And the other day, Sunday, I saw you post on Facebook. What did you say? Best Chinese restaurants in San Diego, go. And I wanted to comment, did you just get out of Crazy Rich Asians?
Okay, you're putting the cart before the horse. We're gonna get there.
Okay.
Why don't you set this movie up for us?
But I was right. I didn't say that because if I was wrong, I would have been racist.
Set it up.
Crazy Rich Asians is the big sleeper hit of the year, and a large reason why we finally got to this, even though it's been out for a few weeks now. It's directed by John M. Chu, which I did not know, and maybe would have got me into the theaters faster had I known. It stars Constance Wu as Rachel Chu, the main character. She is a professor of economics in New York. She's dating a new guy. She's known for a little while. He's a little mysterious, apparently. But he decides he's going to take her to Singapore to meet his big family at a relative's wedding. And upon leaving, she finds out or learns that her boyfriend is crazy rich. And really rich, like comes from old money in Singapore. And when she meets the family, they don't take much of a liking to her because they suspect that she might only be into him for the money. And we get a lot of like cattiness going on with the other women. And then we have some friends who are trying to prop her up and, you know, sort of Pygmalion style, teach her the right way to impress these people, give her fancy clothes and how to walk with books on her head, that kind of stuff. It's a little bit of just a, you know, clash of personality, specifically between Rachel and her boyfriend Nick's mother. It's a kind of a small story told in a really big, lavish, opulent way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now that we've got it set up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I did post that after seeing this movie, because there is a good chunk of this movie that is
food porn?
Yeah. I was going to say food and economics porn.
Yes.
If you're into, like, we've been talking a lot about Batman, if you're into the moments where Batman is being Bruce Wayne and showing off how much money he has, you're going to love this movie because there was a lot of that.
Yes, there is. The movie is shot in a really wide frame, which gives the movie kind of an interesting look and kind of makes it feel much bigger than one of these kind of stories usually is. John M. Chu kind of directs the hell out of this visually. There's a lot of like sweeping cameras, camera shots and helicopter vistas, and these big shots of these mansions that they're walking through, and these decorations and ornate moldings on the walls, and you know, lights and water and fountains and all of the, you know, beautiful dresses, and like this movie is visually kind of arresting sometimes.
It is a gorgeous movie to look at.
Yeah.
I will say there were I did have a little bit of a hard time getting into the movie at first, which is, you know, it's hard for romantic comedies to do all of the exposition stuff in ways that sound natural, because it always feels artificial, because it's like nobody talks about their friends and family this way.
Yeah, you know.
And so, just like the first little bit of it, I was like, okay. I felt like I was settling for this movie. I was like, all right. And then once I get to Singapore, I started really having fun with it. I started really enjoying what was going on.
Do you think that has anything to do with the introduction of Aquafina's character and 100%. Ken Young?
100%. That was the moment where I was like, oh, okay, this is genuinely a comedy. Because up till the point where she's introduced, I didn't really find anything that funny.
Uh-huh.
I was just like, okay, this is just sort of entertaining. And then her character really livened up. It really livened up the movie and really helped me sort of let my guard down.
Well, it gave us an entry point, right? Because if you're not just getting into this for the wish fulfillment aspect of it, if you can't just be sold on hot boyfriend and beautiful houses and dresses and all of this stuff, but her character and Ken Young's character and a couple others along the way, kind of expose the ridiculousness a little bit, kind of heckle the movie from within. So I think that's going to sort of nudge the elbow of the boyfriend or whoever's being dragged along to be like, this movie's kind of for you too. Like, at least you can agree with these characters.
For sure. And it wasn't that I had a problem with the other characters. It just wasn't that funny to me up to that point. Like, there were a couple jokes that were definitely... you know, more for catering to Asian audiences. And I was like, you know, that's totally fine.
There's very culturally specific stuff in this movie, which is actually kind of cool.
No, I thought it was great. But there, especially at the beginning, some of the humor, I just was like, I can't really relate to that. I recognize that it is I see what they're doing. But to me, it's not funny just because I don't really understand.
Yeah, you're like, I guess that's a reference to something. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I got the idea. I was like, okay, yeah, this movie is definitely playing to its audience. But then, once we got to that scene where we're introduced to Awkwafina and Ken Jeong, was like, oh, okay, this is a comedy for everybody.
Yeah, and I'll say I haven't liked Ken Jeong in a movie in. Long time. So it says a lot that he didn't just annoy me from the get-go.
Well, he's playing a very specific character, and usually he's just sort of thrown in to play like a wild card.
Right.
And oftentimes when he's put in that role, it's done in a way that's not really written to make him shine.
Right.
Whereas this definitely was. They were like, we're going to give you an actual character to play off of. It's not just someone being crazy for the sake of being crazy.
Right. And he adds a different texture to the movie. Both characters do. And I suspect, I guess Awkwafina was also in Ocean's 8, which I didn't see. But I suspect off of the success of this movie, we're going to see a lot more of her.
Yeah, I feel like
Hollywood's totally. Not going to know what to do with her, and they're not going to get why they liked her in this movie, and we're going to see her do stuff she shouldn't be doing, but we are going to see a lot more of her.
Yeah, I'm afraid they're going to Tiffany Haddish her.
Yeah.
Which they've already done to Tiffany Haddish, and I'm like, she's talented, you're wasting her on these movies, but whatever.
Right.
Yeah, so at that point in the movie, which is a decent chunk in, it's like 15, 20 minutes in, that was when I really started to sort of let my guard down and just sort of be swept away by the fantasia of it. And for that, it's really good. I mean, I think it is a really fun, it's a movie. It is a feel good movie. Like it you just watch it and you're just sort of enjoying it.
Yeah.
Or at least I was. Yeah, and I do think, I think, A, that's a big part of its success. I'm attributing this to my prediction with La La Land, how we're going to see more brighter sort of wish fulfillment fantasy movies.
Yeah.
I'm counting this in that column. But I think it does it really well. And I think a lot of that is because of the direction. It is appealing to a culture that in Hollywood is largely left unshown. And so I think that representation is great, but I think that's only going to get you so far. It also has to be a good movie. And I think I'll attribute that largely to the direction of it. It's so bright and colorful.
And big.
Yeah, that it's almost shot like a musical.
Well, it is. John M. Chu directed my favorite Step Up movies. Step Up to the Streets.
Okay.
And that Step Up 3D. He also did the sequel to G.I. Joe, which was the better of the two of those.
Oh, yeah, it was.
And he did Gem and the Holograms, which did not do very well, but I didn't see it.
Maybe we should check it out.
Oh, and he did the Justin Bieber documentaries, Never Say Never and whatever the other one was called. Yes, if you look at the Step Up movies, his takes on them, he kind of brings this to that. And that's why I always told people, unironically, that those are really fun. Like, they're terribly acted and the plots are ridiculous, but they're very cinematic. And he treats the dance genre kind of like a tournament karate film. and kind of, it's one of the only movies where the, like, very good use of the 3D thing, and it sort of fits in with his aesthetic. You could have also done that with this movie, with how much visually is happening.
Yeah, for sure.
It wouldn't have even been that weird if this was a 3D movie. He loves set pieces, man. And he loves, he dresses the scene so well.
And there's some great ones in this.
Yeah.
There were moments when I laughed just because of the set piece.
Well, there's a sequence in the beginning when she first walks into the big mansion for the first time, her boyfriend's mother's house, and we're meeting everybody, and it's this long tracking shot, and I'm like, oh, you're doing Scorsese's Coco Cabana scene. Like, that's the visual reference here.
And that's why I keep you for a movie review podcast. No, for sure. It's, yeah, my big criticism with the movie was it was a little hard for me to get into it at first, just because I didn't know who the important characters were. There's this montage where they're introducing cousins, like you would introduce characters in a heist movie.
Yeah.
Actually,
not if we want to go back to Goodfellas, not too unlike that scene where he's like, and there's so and so the shark, and blah, da, 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 and there's two times Jimmy, and da,
sure. Like, it actually specifically reminded me of like Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Where
you just get a little bit of taste, like, this is him, this is what his thing is. And I will say that, you know, there's so many characters, and there's really no movie stars in this movie. Like, Ken Jeong is the biggest name here, which is, again, so surprising. This movie won like 3 weekends in a row.
Michelle Yeoh, she's been in stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people, and there's I think the guy's like a famous dancer or something like that. And Constance Wu, she's in Fresh Off the Boat. Like, all of these, there's a lot of people who are, you know, there's the one guy who's in Silicon Valley, but they're all like character actors, basically. Right. Like,
sure. Yeah. They're not movie stars.
No. There's no movie stars in this movie. There's nobody selling this thing just on them.
I think a big selling point of it was, you know, there's obviously a demographic that was hungry for this. I mean, how many movies do we see, like, big fucking summer tentpole blockbusters do we see that reshoot specific scenes just for an Asian market? So
right, a lot.
So
and I suspect this movie will travel very well.
Oh yeah, and of course that they, you know, it, to me it makes sense. Like, let's appeal to this huge demographic
that
only gets represented as, you know, in kung fu movies, and let's show them as smart and intelligent and not have them do any fucking kung fu, or in let's demystify them and portray them as people and portray them as sexual objects, which especially for, you know, women, Asian women are often fetishized and Asian men are often depicted as unattractive. And this is like the opposite of that. They're like, take a look at our men.
Yeah. Can we get into that a little?
Sure.
Because I had a note. I, before knowing it was John M. Chu, because I was just watching it, and there was a point in the movie about, I don't know, maybe the first meeting with the mother when they're in the kitchen and they're having their kind of showdown. And I said, this might be the gayest movie I've seen all year.
Okay.
And I don't mean that in like a pejorative way. I mean, the sensibility of this movie, very big, very opulent, very campy, and classical camp. I don't mean like John Waters camp. I mean, or like So Bad It's Good or whatever. I mean, like, the movie is putting everything, you know, including the set pieces, including the dialogue, including the characters, putting everything in quotation marks in sort of a campy way. And then there's these beefcake shots of the guys and just spraying themselves down in the shower. And we get two very prominent gay characters in the movie who kind of come and save the day. And then when I found out it was directed by John M. Chu and checked his Wikipedia page and found out that he's married to a lady, I got a little confused because the sensibility of this movie to me is very, very gay.
I do agree with that, but I think a big
people part are allowed of it- to disagree, by the way, too. I mean, that was just me. I'm constantly thinking about things in those terms, but other opinions are available, I'm sure.
And to be clear, I there's no gay story plot.
No. I meant that in like a, I mean, the specifically the kind of references here, like not the Scorsese ones, actually, but the like, just the type of movie it is, the way it feels, it kind of feels like an old, like, My Fair Lady kind of thing, or it feels a little bit like some of the comedy parts and the dialogue. It feels a little bit like a Doris Day, Rock Hudson kind of joint. Yeah. Like, it has that kind of, like, quick, fluffy kind of cuteness to it, and those movies are big for that audience.
I think a couple things. I think, first of all, it's trying to be an effective romantic comedy. And when was the last actual earnest
romantic comedy?
Yeah. You know, it's been a while.
Yeah, well, that's a thing. And, you know, I texted my mom and my sister after seeing this. I didn't know if this was the type of thing that would be on their radar, even though it's done so well. I said, you should go see this movie because it reminds me the most of the heyday of the romantic comedy. It's like, you know, late 90s or whatever. Yeah, Nora Ephron comedies.
We actually just talked about Clueless. There's actually some elements of it that kind of reminded me of Clueless.
Yeah, sure. And I think that there was a point in time where the romantic comedy was a staple of populist cinema. Like, just as much as the superhero movies, just as much as an alien invasion movie, the romantic comedy, you would usually be as big of a player in the box office as any of those other things. Now, not so much. Like, in the last 10 or 11 years, not so much.
Well, I think it's because a couple things. I think there hasn't been an earnest effort to make one of substance in a long time. I think it became so formalized.
Yeah.
That it was like, okay, we just cookie cutter, blah, 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 and then we'll put Matthew McConaughey here, and then we'll put Katherine Heigl here. Bingo, bango, we got a hit.
Yeah.
And they didn't actually take any effort into crafting a somewhat relatable story. Whereas this, I think the reason Crazy Rich Asians was successful is because of a lot of things. First of all, it's the first romantic comedy in a long time to treat its characters with any kind of respect.
Yes.
Especially the female characters. They're running the show. I loved how resourceful and intelligent they were portrayed as. They weren't fetishized. So you're also playing to a huge demographic that does not normally get played to. And it's just really fun on top of all of this.
It's a little long. I'll say that for the kind of movie it is. I think there is a cut that's 12 minutes shorter that might have worked a little bit better for me.
The only reason I'll kind of disagree with you on that is because it took me so long to get into the movie that once I was enjoying it, I wanted to live in that world and play in it. So,
well, yeah, anything, I think there's an argument here. Quentin Tarantino calls this the hangout movie, which is what he considers Jackie Brown to be at sort of a leisurely pace.
Sure.
Or like Dazed and Confused, or one of his go-tos is Rio Bravo, is being a hangout movie where it's less about like getting into the scene and having the scene accomplish what the character need to do and then getting out of the scene as quickly as possible. And it's more about just kind of living in the world and just getting to hang out with the characters.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, that is, I will say that I agree with you, but I think we could have just gotten to the fun a little bit faster.
Yeah, well, one of my other big criticisms of the movie, and this is, I think, story-wise, the most important one, and it kind of, like, leads into another criticism I have, is that we don't get to know that much about Rachel Wu and Nick Young, Rachel Chu and Nick Young's relationship before this event. It's not terribly well established, and I think since the whole movie is pretending to be about class struggle, then it kind of comes off as a little bit of thematic hypocrisy when it's, you know, saying like, oh, isn't it so bad that she's being looked down upon because her career isn't good enough and for these people, and you know, her boyfriend has to choose between his family and this woman that he loves and tradition and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it is like totally turning this wealth into sort of a masturbatory fantasy throughout the movie. So I think if we had actually got to see like a scene, maybe in flashback or maybe instead of the early scenes that we did get of them, you know, being on the airplane or whatever, of her living in her like one bedroom Manhattan studio or whatever, and get a feel for not that, because even her only mostly rich but not as rich friend lives in a giant mansion with a fountain.
Yeah, yeah.
So we never see that. And there is a little bit of, like, let's not show the ugly people.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's intentional, because I think that's...
Oh, I think it's intentional, too, just not for good reasons.
I'm not going to say it's not for good reasons, because I think it's actually really cool to see a culture that is usually portrayed as comic relief or as ugly to be portrayed as beautiful and sexy. So I didn't have a problem with that. I do think that you could have portrayed, the lower class lifestyle a little differently.
It's not even lower class, though. Like, she's a university teacher living in New York. Like, she's probably making six figures. She just isn't a gajillionaire who can rent a yacht in the middle of open waters.
I think, that's insane. I think the thing that really makes it work for me is the B story with...
Oh, really?
Jemma Chan's character.
Yeah.
Because she's sort of going through a similar thing as the main character, but in reverse.
She's at the end of a relationship instead of at the beginning.
Yeah, so you really see a manifestation of what could go wrong in Rachel and Nick's relationship. So
yeah.
To me, that's sort of what brought it all home.
Interesting.
I was surprised how much screen time the movie dedicated to that story.
I was too.
And I was loving it, though. I was very intrigued by it. And just, again, I think we just could have sort of gotten to that a little bit sooner, because even that B storyline is sort of introduced a little late. But to me, that's sort of what makes the whole A story work.
Okay. I wasn't always into that story, and sometimes I thought that it broke up the flow of events a little too much or created some weird pacing. But I didn't hate it either. I saw what they were doing, paralleling the two relationships and all that, and I thought it mostly comes together. But I thought it was a little bulky sometimes, the way they cross-cut between the two things.
See, I really liked it because it kind of broke up the pace of this, we're just going to be showing you these gratuitous literal money shots.
Yeah.
And then it brought it back down and sort of regrounded the movie for me.
Yeah, that was definitely like the more like there's this little melodrama hiding in this big overblown comedy.
And I think that I don't know. I think the movie actually really needed it.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that there's just a little bit more tension in the movie. I mean, you know, there's all the family drama and stuff. But that was just a little more, not even predictable, but just a little more standard to me.
Oh, I would say predictable. I think this movie is very comfortable with its cliches. And I don't even mean that necessarily in a bad way. I think it said, you know, these are the things that people want to see in these type of stories. You know, this is essentially My Big Fat Greek Wedding meets,
yes, that's
you
exactly
know, Pygmalion.
What I said. It actually reminds me so much of My Big Fat Greek Wedding, also in the success of it.
Yeah, the surprise success, because it was this little movie out of nowhere starring nobody really famous, except for a Backstreet Boy as a third build character. And it ended up being this huge success.
It's speaking to a very specific...
very specific audience. And also, I think My Big Fat Greek Wedding was, up until maybe somewhat recently, I haven't looked it up in a while, but was the most successful independent film of all time.
Yeah.
As far as recoup.
I think it was until Paranormal Activity.
Yeah, which wouldn't have been too much longer or too much far after. But yeah, I think that's... this movie is... I looked it up. It cost $30 million to make. Of course, that's before marketing, but... they used every dollar on screen because would think it would be much
surprised.
More than that.
I was actually curious with the budget. I was expecting it to be closer to 80 to 100 million.
No, and that's why this is why I think John M. Chu is a good director and could, you know, given the right material, he could do more than Step Up movies if he wanted to, because I think he's very, very good at using his budget and framing his shots, and I think he could be a really crackerjack visual director if people gave him something to do with it.
Hey, a movie like this is them.
It's going to launch a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, fuck yeah. But, you know, a movie like this is, I think it's cool to see him do that with a movie like this versus a big bloated action movie or whatever. Like,
right.
If I compare this to G.I. Joe, this stands out a lot more to me because it's not a movie that it's not the type of movie that I'm used to seeing shot this way.
Right. And it's more specific, and it's I mean, it's definitely playing into a genre, but it feels like he has to be a little bit more clever with it than rather than just like, let's have a giant special effect here, and then these characters everyone already knows here, and da da da.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed this quite a bit, despite some of my criticisms. I think that it is a really good romantic comedy, very traditional. The people who have been pining for this type of thing are going to be happy for with it. I give it a solid B.
Okay, I'm actually going to give it a two letter grades. I'm doing something a little weird here. I'm going to say as a romantic comedy itself, a B plus.
Okay,
but due to the timeliness of it, I think it actually is I'm gonna curve it a little higher, because it stands out like an island right now.
The moment and of it.
Yeah. And it was so refreshing.
The zeitgeist.
To go to a movie and see a movie like this right now was so refreshing. To go in and not have to deal with, you know, and I love my big budget blockbuster movies. But I want to see more movies like this right now. And I think, you know, that's probably why I liked La La Land so much. And that's not even normally the type of movie I would have normally liked. I'm growing soft in my old age. But due to its timeliness, I'm actually going to give it an A-.
All right. There you go. I'll let you go ahead. We're going to talk about our Netflix homework now. And I'll let you set up Tale of Tales, the movie you assigned me last week.
Yeah. So this is a fantasy movie with sort of three separate storylines going, of three separate kings.
Sort of interweaved.
Kings and queens, yeah. Interweaved. So the first story is about Selma Hayek is this queen. She'll do anything to have a child. And then when she finally has a child, she's overprotective of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads, to some ironic fairy tale shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
The next story is Vincent Cassell is this king who is this...
a drunkard and a sex addict.
Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to think of more... poetic ways to put it, but yeah, he's a very lecherous king who has fucked everyone in the kingdom to the point of boredom until he hears this mysterious woman singing out his window. He doesn't get a good look at her, and instantly falls in love with her based on her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And her sister are these old crones that sort of tease him eventually seduce him. And then there's some more fairy tale shenanigans. And then the third story is Toby Jones is this king who has this daughter who he's sort of inattentive of. And he spends his time raising this flea to the detriment of his daughter. And again, more fairy tale shenanigans without giving too much away.
Okay. You're holding back way more than I would have.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there's creatures and monsters and, you know, morality plays.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairy tale. It is a straight up fairy tale. It's very high fantasy. There's giant fleas. There's
ogres.
Sea serpents. There's an ogre. There's traveling carnival people. There's skin changers. All sorts of fun fantasy shenanigans.
Yes.
So what did you think of Tale of Tales?
I knew very little about this movie going into it, other than I've seen the one sheet of Selma Hayek with a giant heart and a bloody face, and thought, okay, this could be an interesting event here. And I didn't really know what to expect. It's, you know, directed by an Italian director. And I kind of went in blind. And I'm kind of glad that I did, because it starts off kind of slow. And it has this very accumulative, structure where you're slowly introduced to all these different story threads and then they kind of go back and forth between them. And it takes a little bit of time to kind of figure out, how they're balancing all these different story threads. And there was a point where I was like, okay, this movie's a little too into itself or something, a little too academic feeling or something. I wasn't quite sure.
Self-indulgent?
A little bit, yeah. Or a little too artsy or whatever, what have you, for its own good. But then once I got a feel for how these stories connect, the story, the overall narrative that it's trying to portray, this kind of like, basically, you know, the overarching theme is be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot of stuff about obsession and overprotectedness and that kind of stuff too.
And that's also, you know, pretty common thematic ground for
these type of stories. Yeah, morality tales. And once I knew that, and I saw how traditional it actually was, then I said, "Oh no! This movie isn't too artsy or pretentious at all. This movie is just." Doing this style of fantasy, this kind of non-Campbellian, very European, Märchen tale or whatever you want to call it, style fantasy, and doing it to a T, and doing it really well. And I came away really enjoying it. And I love the way it looks. It's beautifully shot.
Another very, visually stunning film.
Yeah, lots of like individual shots you can just kind of pause and look at, and enjoy that way. The cinematographer did a lot of Cronenberg's movies, actually. I looked at his past work and he's done almost everything of Cronenberg since like the mid-80s.
That kind of makes sense, actually.
Yeah, there's some body horror stuff in this movie. I don't think that's necessarily what he was brought on to hype, but it has an effect.
No, I just, yeah.
I think most of the performances are really good. At first I wasn't sure because they're kind of overmannered, but then I got what they were going for and I kind of,
yeah, this movie, it does not apologize for what it is. And it doesn't, it doesn't really, make it easy for the audience to get into it. It is unapologetically, high fantasy fairy tale.
Yeah, and it's not, again, not in that sort of Lord of the Rings Campbellian hero story kind of fantasy that most people are familiar with. No, nobody has to go and defeat a dragon and that kind of stuff. I mean, things like that happen, but not for the same reasons.
No, yeah.
There's no one ring to rule them all. There's no, person who's a messiah figure or anything like that. Stuff that people most commonly associate with the type of fantasy that's being told now. This is pretty dark stuff. There's no winners in these stories.
It feels like sort of a collection of like Grimm's fairy tales.
Yeah. Very German style.
Yeah. I was expecting a bit of a framing device. I thought it would actually be. I thought it would actually be like more short stories,
more Creepshow style.
Yeah, or like, you know, Arabian Nights or something like that.
Yeah,
but I wasn't disappointed when it wasn't that.
Yeah.
But that was sort of more what I was expecting. I agree. This movie is a little prickly at first.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't. Really explain what it is, but I also found that sort of refreshing.
Me too. Once I got to the place when I know what the when I figured out the tone it was going for.
Yeah,
because it kind of feels like The Adventures of Baron Munchausen as done through the style of like Pasolini's The Canterbury Tales. Like it's like more naturalized. No, I think
that's actually a pretty good a pretty good summation of it, actually. And also, like, not just like the shots, but also like the monsters that are there are genuinely horrifying.
Cool. There's a little bit of a Del Toro-y vibe sometimes.
Yeah, there's some pretty like high horror moments.
Yeah, when it goes there, it doesn't hold back.
No, not at all.
In fact, I would be surprised if like there's a specific character in here, this like ogre character who like kidnaps this girl. He looks exactly like John Barryman from The Hills Have Eyes.
Yes.
Like with the fur pelt on his back and everything.
Yeah, and the odd shape face
and like the way he chokes out everybody. Like I feel like that was definitely a reference.
Yeah. I can see that for sure. There's a lot of storytelling through color as well,
yeah,
which I thought was cool. I fucking dig this shit.
Yeah.
This
kind of folklore-ish stuff.
Yeah, like I took a folklore class in college that I really liked, and this just reminded me of a lot of those stories we had to read back then. Again, it's all sort of sort of like Greek tragedy. A lot of them have very ironic punishments.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of morality telling, things like that. Yeah,
I thought this movie was pretty lit, and I actually I went from kind of being standoffish to it to really, really winning me over. And
I agree. I kind of had the same thing. At first I was like, okay. But then near the end I was like, oh, kind of? Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Now, I will say, and maybe this is one of the reasons both of us kind of had to struggle at the beginning of it, the Selma Hayek story, which is the one that sort of introduces us into this world, is, I think, the least interesting. And yeah, it's about one story too long as far as length and everything goes. I think if we had done without that story, I think it would be a stronger film and it would be a more appropriate length too. It has its own, it's doing its own stuff, and there's some stuff from it that I like a lot. But I think overall, like, those characters aren't as interesting. Like, the overall message or whatever we're supposed to be getting out of that story, I think, is accomplished elsewhere in the movie with other characters better.
I agree and I disagree. I do agree that it is sort of the least interesting. And perhaps that could have just been addressed by making those segments shorter.
Yeah.
But I do think the way this movie is broken up, I do think you do sort of need the three stories working together. The story with Selma Hayek is sort of our framing device. It's sort of the inciting action that connects the three stories.
Yeah.
But well, and I think it's broken up in cool ways, but I see what you're saying, but I think, yeah, maybe that could have just been a little shorter, but I think that story is pretty necessary. I think as far as story goes, I think the one that's has the least amount of payoff is the one with Vincent Cassell. Because I feel like that one at the end feels the least resolved.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I'd say I thought the same with the Selma Hayek one too. Both of those, I was expecting one more scene from each. I thought there wasn't as much of a tie up. The one with the ogre, it's like the most, to me, like the most complete.
Well, yeah, and I also think that's also sort of the story, the movie ender.
Yeah.
And that's, definitely where sort of the most action's at.
Yeah.
And that whole
and the most comedy sequence too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love the creature design in this movie so much. That flea is so cute, but also horrifying.
Yeah. The giant flea.
Yeah. I was expecting it to eat the doctor when it was sick.
Yeah, agreed.
But that in sequence is pretty horrifying.
Oh, for sure, yeah. There's a good handful of chunks in this movie where like, ooh, this is actually pretty gruey.
Yeah. I would recommend this movie if you're into folklore driven horror.
Yeah, or I don't even think you, I mean, I think horror fans, a certain kind of horror fan, will enjoy this movie. Especially like if you grew up during the time of like Return to Oz and like Neverending Story and like that type of stuff, or you know, Legend and those type of movies. This is almost kind of like a more grown up version of that.
Yeah, it actually kind of the Ogre Story had a lot of stuff that sort of reminded me of The Princess Bride.
Yeah, actually. A little bit. Yeah,
but definitely a much more adult version, like Princess Bride meets Coppola's Dracula.
Yeah. Or even like, you know, Time Bandits and those other like Gilliam things. Yeah. It has a root in like that kind of fantasy, which again, we haven't seen in a while because everything's been so strictly Campbellian since Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of miss it, actually.
I think that's why I ended up liking this movie so much is like, oh, wow. You just don't see this kind of fantasy very often. Outside of a Del Toro movie.
Yes, yeah. I think you can feel shades of it in Game of Thrones, but I feel like that's definitely more rooted in I don't know. It's somewhere in between. But yeah. No, I agree. It was sort of refreshing.
Yeah. So I definitely recommend it, and I haven't seen the other films by this director, Matteo Garrone. I would go back and watch his other movies. I don't think they're anything like this. I think they're more modern, kind of like grounded or whatever, but I could be wrong. But I think I'm going to take a look because this impressed me quite a bit.
Yeah, I was happy with it.
Next week for the Netflix homework, I'm going to have us watch the 1976 version of A Star is Born. Starring Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson, in preparation of the remake, the third remake of this story that's coming out here in October. So we'll be doing that. And if anybody has anything to say about that or Tale of Tales or Crazy Rich Asians or anything we talk about in this or past episodes, you can email us at jabberandrone@gmail.com and we'll read your thoughts there. You can also contact us on Twitter at jabberpodcast or on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're also on Instagram where you can instantly gram us at jabberpodcast as well. You can read my reviews I do for the Idaho State Journal at salvorkreviews.blogspot.com. You can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can find and stream the podcast at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And I think that's all I have to say. What about you?
You can follow me on Twitter, which I'm deciding to reclaim as a comedy outlet and nothing more. fuck off with all your opinions. You're all wrong. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, for upcoming show dates.
All right. And be sure to check out our friends on the internet who also do podcasts. Patrick Adenis over at Almost Educational, Rod Moksha over at The Listening Party, Bill and Brian over at The Great Albums Podcast, Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought.
Check out Adam Connie at The Adamant Podcast, and Meryl and Bo at Campfire Shit Show. Oh, and that episode of the Super Friends podcast with Keith James dropped, and you should listen to that. It gets real weird.
Yeah, I believe I put that on our Twitter, so if people are following us on Twitter, they can see where I put that, and you can follow the link to that streamer. I think it's SoundCloud is what that's on right now.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. That's it.
All right, and make sure you eat all your food because there's kids starving in America.
Huh?
That was the sign out. It was a quote from Crazy Rich Asians.
Oh, okay. Bye.